this week on The Inswinger.
Southgate, I really respect him for what he did. The shoehorning in and the tweaks, it was worth a go, but it doesn't work. You're going to have superstars on the bench.
I think France will have a point to prove because they're going to come back wanting revenge.
The way De La Fuente has them playing is unlike any other team in international football.
I think 2026 is going to be a seminal moment, not just for U.S. soccer, but for football across the world. Good afternoon and welcome back to The Inswinger Season 4, Episode 10. We're at double digits. I'm Charlie DiMatteo, joined alongside
Harrison McGlashan.
It's the dreaded international break for us Premier League and club football fans as the international teams meet up at camp. Some of them will, some of them won't. There was some chat amongst the England squad about guys kind of withdrawing. Harry Kane even came out and said England should be ahead of clubs. That's something we can maybe get into, where players' priority should be. But this week on the Instagram, we're going to take a look forward to 2026 and the spring, late spring, early summer of 2026, the World Cup, which will be hosted in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. But really, the final will be in the U.S., the opening game will be in the U.S., and I think the majority of the knockout round games will be here. So what a spectacle that's going to be. Harrison, this has been on the radar for a while now. I feel like since we've been in college, really, we've known that the World Cup is going to be hosted by these three countries in 2026. What are you looking forward to the most about just the occasion of the World Cup in the United States, especially after we had to deal with all the Qatar controversy, lack of football culture? I mean, what are you looking forward to for the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, listen, although football is not the the top sport in this country, it is, I would say, the fastest growing sport. It's got a fast growing league. So I'm really excited about the prospect of hosting, just in terms of growing the game. We know the interest is there at youth level and how many kids are playing soccer in this country, but in terms of the fandom and the culture around it, what this could maybe do for MLS and helping filling those stadiums, that's really what I want to see. I want to see a passionate American base grow, because there is a base sort of starting to form. You've got the hipsters and the American outlaws, and it's fun to see. The U.S. is sort of implementing their own brand on this sport, which I think is important. You don't want to be just an out-and-out copycat of a European nation or a South American nation. So that's been fun to see, but I think this is really the climax of a growing soccer culture in the U.S., which I am ecstatic to see, obviously, what the U.S. can do and how the U.S. fans are going to turn out and what they can learn and see and mesh with other countries and other fans. I think that's going to be so fun to see on our own turf in 2026.
Yeah, I think 2026 is going to be a seminal moment, not just for U.S. soccer, but for football across the world, because it'll be the biggest World Cup in history, expanded format in the U.S. Not only do you have a U.S. men's national team that is growing in quality, and we'll get into Poch and all of that later on, but you have a U.S. club culture that's growing thanks to the addition of Lionel Messi at Inter Miami. What that's done for U.S. soccer and the MLS, like you touched on, has been huge. So it's going to be really interesting to see the crossroads between that. And then you'll have global stars that are becoming more and more, not household names, but I feel like Mbappe, you know, post the 2022 World Cup, you know, they were talking about Mbappe on PTI and like on SportsCenter, and I think you're starting to see a bit more of that with the Premier League and these global stars like Bellingham, and they'll be on full display in America and at some huge markets in LA and New York. So it's going to be really exciting.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, the average sports fan, not even soccer fan in this country, I would argue, doesn't know yet quite what soccer is about.
Yeah.
And I think anyone who is fortunate enough to go to a World Cup game in sort of that neutral section, because it will be commercialized.
Yeah.
There will be people there who aren't diehard fans. That's inevitable. I'm excited to see the reaction to the Argentina fans on one end and the Brazil fans on another end, and just the culture around this sport. That is why it is the beautiful game, in my opinion.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the firsthand look people are going to get is going to be great.
Yes.
And there are going to be games all across the country, a lot of NFL stadiums. I don't think there's any MLS stadiums, just because of capacity-wise, they're not big enough.
They're playing at BMO in Toronto. Is that MLS?
Oh, you're right.
Toronto FC, right?
Yeah, that's right.
That's probably the one. Maybe Mexico has a big
round.
But at least in the U.S., it's all NFL.
Yeah, and the World Cup final will be at MetLife, which is going to be a little crazy. The fact that it's in technically New Jersey, you know, as the bird flies, it's closer to Manhattan than where the Mets and Yankees play, but it's in New Jersey. I'm looking forward to all the whoever gets it, like if whoever wins and advances, as they're looking for hotels and Airbnbs, they're like, "Where's the stadium? It's in a different state." I think that'll be funny.
Yes, the traffic is going to be unbearable.
Unbearable. Yeah, I might just camp out and just witness the chaos.
Yeah,
because Lord knows I'm not going to be able to afford a ticket. I do want to talk about tickets a little bit. An interesting comparison is the Ryder Cup, which is golf's tournament between the U.S. and the Europeans, is going to be in Bethpage in New York in 2025, and they just sold out. But the average ticket price for that, now granted, that's a four-day event, it's golf, it's a different sport, was $800. Do you think Infantino and FIFA are going to just make these tickets ridiculous beyond reason? Because they know it's America. People are willing to pay. You're going to get these neutrals coming in. I think they'll keep the fans from the nation's tickets okay price, but you know, for people like us who are just trying to go see a game, is it going to be extortionate?
It might be. It certainly will be on the secondary sites, and FIFA's already warned people, hey, do not buy the resale tickets. I think you can already go on StubHub and buy a ticket for $2,000. I don't know where they're getting those tickets from, because they're not going to release – FIFA are not going to release tickets on their website till late 2025, which is good. I think it's we'll get a better picture of who's qualified and all of that stuff. That makes sense. So I think the first dibs might be okay. I think residents probably get a priority. I think I've heard that. But, you know, they're going to go like hotcakes, and then you're going to be looking at the resale market, and that's going to be
absurd,
pretty absurd. So, you know, it's tough for us because although we went to an England game in March, I don't think we're on the sort of England fan list as much as I'd love to be. So those guys are going to get the seats behind the goal, and then the opposition will get the other goal. It's the middle section. I'm curious how they're going to stagger that. Can you prove that you live in New York and therefore get a ticket to MetLife? I'm not quite sure how it works. But when you look at Qatar, I mean, there were a lot of Qataris sort of
there.
So I think Americans will be able to attend. The pricing is sort of the big elephant in the room,
though. Yeah, we'll see about that. We will see. All right, let's get into some of the teams I want to preview. I want to start with the reigning European champion, Spain. I think Spain took a lot of people by surprise this summer with just how clinical they were. Because I feel like Spain, even in years where they haven't been performing well, I'm thinking back to Qatar in 2022, the Euros in 2020. I feel like they always play beautiful stuff. You know, it's tiki-taka. But it's always kind of a question of, do they have that killer instinct to put goals away and win games? And really, it was the youthful brilliance of Lamine Yamal. Dani Olmo had a great tournament that kind of propelled them to win the Euros. I mean, right now they're ranked third in the world behind Argentina and France. But, I mean, you can make a case that they're as good as both those teams, if not better. Where do you see them heading into 2026? Because these young players are only going to get better in the next, you know, 18 months.
Yeah, you could make a great argument that they're the favorites. I'd probably have them as the favorites after how they played at the Euros, man. They were the best team to watch. They played the best football. I don't know that they have the best team on paper in the world, maybe hence their ranking. You know, Morata's up front, and, you know, there's still a few guys kind of kicking around who, you know, are not of the best quality in the world in their position. But the way De La Fuente has them playing is unlike any other team in international football. I mean, this game of international football is often not about who can be sort of the sexiest on the ball. I mean, France won the World Cup in 2018 with a solid base, first and foremost, and they had some brilliant players that took care of business in attack, right? So it's a little more old school sometimes in international football. But Spain have ripped that up every time they've won it, right? They look fantastic on the ball and a little bit different to the Spain teams of old. You know, out-and-out wingers.
Yeah.
Sort of a freedom for Williams and Yamal to sort of take defenders on and be a bit more unpredictable, you know, than the Spain teams of old. We were playing, you know, David Silva on one wing, and just it was all technical midfield players just sort of buzzing around.
So
there's no real right or wrong answer, but it's interesting how they've sort of shifted ever so slightly their style of play. So yeah, I think Spain are fantastic. They're well drilled. And of course, the maybe the most important thing is they've won a tournament. They've been there, done it. They've proved that they can beat the best. Of course, you know, we've got Argentina and Brazil to throw into the mix, but you know, we can get onto those teams and maybe Brazil at a bit of a crossroads, Messi aging out. I wouldn't have either of those teams as the favorite for 2026. But again, a lot can change. Of course, it's way too early to, you know, put a strong prediction out there.
These are our way too early predictions. We're kind of forecasting it. And the next team I want to forecast is England, the team that lost to Spain in the Euros final. It will be Thomas Tuchel leading them at this tournament. I think England are in a unique position that, you know, they have guys that are established like Harry Kane. I mean, Jude Bellingham will be, he is established already, but he's going to be in the prime of his career. Same with Foden and Palmer and Saka and whoever else. The list goes on and on. But like you said, is this the tournament that England can not be? It was kind of the case at Euros. They weren't playing great, but they were getting results, and they just fell that little bit short. Is Tuchel the guy to get them over the line? I think he's as good a guy as you're going to get, and we talked about that when they hired him. But where are you with England? I mean, we previewed them a little bit when they hired Tuchel, but it really does seem like World Cup or bust.
Yeah, and I'm fine with that. I think you have to go for it now. Like you said, so many players entering the prime of their career. I think the theme will be, I think England have to show some balls. I think they have to show some balls on the ball. They have to be a little bit braver at times. And I think the manager has to and will show a bit of balls in, you can't play everyone, you know? And I think Southgate, I really respect him for what he did and leading us to two finals. But I think the shoehorning in and the tweaks and, you know, it was worth a go, but it doesn't work. I think you're going to have superstars on the bench. And you know what? That's fine because it's a one-off tournament and substitutes can play a huge role. I mean, Palmer was brilliant off the bench and, you know, you could argue he has to start. He doesn't have to start, right? Let him do his thing. It's a one-off tournament. Play a balanced team, because that was a big theme in the Euros, with the left-hand side especially. I know Luke Shaw wasn't fit, and the balance wasn't there with Foden, Trippier. It didn't quite work. So I hope that Tuchel can sort of stamp his own authority and ideas on this team and sort of have the balls to play the right team and sort of manage the squad in a way that is most effective, right? And I don't think the most effective way for England to go forward is to play Foden and Saka and Palmer and Bellingham all on the same team. Right. I just think it's impossible. So I'd like to see a bit more balance about the team. And I trust Tuchel to do that. I think he's a good blend of sort of pragmatism. He's got a great tournament record, but he can also play some good stuff. I'm not expecting us to come and knock it around like Spain. But that's okay. You don't have to necessarily win a tournament playing like Spain every time. I think there are – England were in that game. They were close. Yeah. So they just need a bit more edge, a bit more guile, a bit more bottle in the attacking third, and, you know, maybe an impact off the bench. That's the thing that can win these games, these tournament
small
games.
Small margins.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really interesting stuff for England, and having a German head coach, that's going to be fascinating to watch. All right, before we get into a couple more – superpowers, I should say, the two finalists, Argentina, France. I do want to touch on the U.S. And the U.S. have brought in Mauricio Pochettino as their manager, a bold move. I think as good a move as you could make if you're the U.S. Soccer Federation. I don't think you're going to do any better than Mauricio Pochettino. And I think Mauricio Pochettino is a perfect fit for the U.S. because of his career and resume and when things have gone well for him. Mauricio Pochettino, his best stint was at Tottenham with a young core who he could shape and play energized football, not with the big stars at PSG. That was never really going to work, not at Chelsea when there was just too much going on off the field with the boardroom. I feel like Pochettino, with these players, he'll see them every once in a while, he'll gel them together, play an attacking style that we saw in their win last night against Jamaica. They were brilliant with Pulisic at the 10, not out on the wing, Pepe up top, Tim Weah scored a brilliant goal, McKennie was influencing the game all over the place, and you got Musa and Adams in the midfield. The core is there. We know that. How far can they go? I don't know. I think it's unrealistic to predict anything further than a quarterfinal, but can you get there? Maybe if the draw is kind enough, you're at home field. It's a massive opportunity for the U.S., and I love that Pochettino is the guy right now. But we'll see if expectations play an impact, because at Qatar, it was kind of like, all right, you got here. That was the minimum after missing out in 2018. Now, with these players, with Pochettino, with on home turf, will that expectation get to them? I don't know. How do you see the U.S. shaping up in a couple of years'
Listen,
time?
Listen, I like the squad, and I like the fact that they've been playing together. This team, this is a consistent team we're starting to see now with McKennie, Musa, Adams, Pulisic. The spine of the team has stayed consistent, so it's some fresh faces, but I think they'll be ready to take the next step. And I think a manager like Pochettino, I mean, if he can't do it, who can, right? At this level, he's proven, like you said, he's got a proven track record of working with sort of a similar profile of squad, albeit at club level. But I think they've got a good blend of experience and youth. They've got a few new faces coming through who maybe by 2026 will be sort of ready. I'm looking at, you know, the likes of Pepe maybe. Could he make an impact finally? Because he hasn't really sort of done it at the highest level for, you know, international football yet. Balogun coming through is going to be huge. He's going to be the guy. So there's some pieces that I really like about this team. And I'm with you on, I think, knockout football has to be the minimum. Quarterfinal, I think, would be great. And, you know, we'll see who they get in the group and in the draw. But why not, right? I think the quality is there to make a bit of a run.
All right, I want to end with the two finalists from 2022, Argentina and France. I want to start with France because there's been a bit of turmoil. Mbappe was not in the most recent camp. I don't know what's going on in particular. There were some issues with his form at Madrid. You know, he's being shoehorned in and is playing as that number nine with Vinicius down on the left. That's causing a trickle-down effect, affecting the French national team, which always, always, always seems to have some drama
going on. Yeah.
It's just a soap opera. Really is. That being said, France are going to come ready with a talented team like they always have. Deschamps has been there and done that. He's the most experienced international coach in the game right now. I think France will have a point to prove because I think a lot of people didn't expect them to make, I mean, I say this, they had a brilliant team, but I think a lot of people were like, you know, it's really hard to, you know, win back-to-back World Cups. Maybe us had a couple of us had them predict going out earlier than penalties in the final than they did. They're going to come back wanting revenge. Where do you see them in a couple of years' time? Do you think there's a risk that something derails them off the pitch, or do you think, hey, this team's really good? If everything goes well and clicks, there's no reason why they can't win it.
Yeah, I see that as the case, to be honest. I think that they've been here before. We've heard the turmoil before. Deschamps is still there. He gets results in these tournaments. You know, I know they didn't win the Euros, but man, the talent is just unbelievable. And it feels like every year they've got like somebody else who teams are going to have to deal with. You know what I mean? And now you're thinking about, you know, Olise wasn't even in the Euro squad. And look at the season he's having. He's unbelievable. I mean, the defense at center back, they're so stacked. And I think that has proven to help them out in these tournaments. Just their roster has been, I think, the best in the world the past few years, and they've made it pretty deep since winning the World Cup. So I don't worry too much about France. I think they'll be ready to go when the time comes. The Mbappe drama, I think that's a Madrid problem. He always turns up, and they'll find somebody who can sort of play off of, whether it's Kolo Muani or Giroud, you know, whatever. They've got guys who can accommodate Mbappe. And the wide talent that's coming through who could maybe play in that front three, I'm thinking, you know, Barcola, Olise, like I said, you know, Dembele. It's unbelievable, the talent. And Nkunku, haven't even mentioned him. He's sort of had a slow start-ish at Chelsea, but they played Touram up there. Like, they've just got so many options. So I think they're a big contender to win it. It pains me to say because I'm sort of sick of them. But they're good. They're not going anywhere.
And lastly, Argentina. I think Argentina are at a really interesting point because Portugal and Ronaldo kind of had to deal with this, you know, well, he's a legend. He's their best player ever, arguably the greatest player ever in the history of the game. But he's kind of holding back the team. Messi at MLS, you know, he's still playing well, but it's MLS. And he was pretty good at the Copa America this past summer. But, you know, I don't think he was the best or as good as he was in 2022. I think you're starting to see that drop off. So how will Argentina cope with, you know, Messi's still going to have to play? It seems like that locker room is kind of, they were all rallying around him in Qatar, and it paid off, and they won, and they were a great, well-balanced team. I think Scaloni pressed all the right buttons. That was obviously the breakout tournament for Enzo Fernandez. McAllister was brilliant. Julian Alvarez, who's had a quiet start to life at Atletico Madrid, but we know what he can do on a global stage. So I think Argentina are in a tricky position because there's probably a part of Scaloni that wants to say, hey, Messi, I know you've done all this for us, but maybe you don't get into my best 11. But then if you do that, you almost can't do that. So it's a really tricky one for Argentina heading into this World Cup.
Yeah, they're playing him. You know, yeah. He's going to play. I don't think it's going to be their year again. I think that was the fairy tale in Qatar. And you know what? You're right. Scaloni had them set up well. Alvarez was perfect to play alongside Messi. It just worked from back to front. They were deserved winners. McAllister and Fernandez, you know, it was a sort of a perfect storm, I thought, aside from the first game against Saudi Arabia, yeah. Which is a one-off. But I don't see it this time around. I just see them coming up against a Spain or even a Germany who looked good in the Euros, yeah. France, maybe even in England. We'll see how they look against Tuchel. And I just think I'm not sure they're going to have enough. You know, I'm not saying that Messi's a passenger, but, you know, the way these teams are trying to press now and things like that, I'm not sure Argentina will be up to the task. You know, maybe another couple of years of Garnacho, could he be sort of a new guy to come through and really, really take the games by the scruff of the neck? But, I mean, how old is Messi going to be in 2026? I mean, I think it's a bit of the same thing with Ronaldo in Portugal. I'm not sure he works. I mean, I'm not going to say he doesn't work, but I don't think he wins it for them this time around. I think you're going to need a bit more. I think the European sides are going to come back into it and think this is our year. I mean, so how many teams will think they can win this World Cup? I think England will. I think Spain will. I think France will.
Brazil always think they can.
Brazil will be out for vengeance for sure. So I thought last time around it was really like everybody kind of thought France, and we thought maybe Argentina would be a perfect storm for them. Messi, sort of fairy tale. I think he should have got out on the high, to be honest. I don't know what more he has to prove. Literally. Yeah. Like, just enjoy. I mean, of course, he loves playing for his country.
I think it's
that,
just the vibes are good right now. It's kind of like a farewell tour, like, and without the possibility of it being a sad ending, because, like, even if they go out in the knockout in the group stage, it'll be like, remember Qatar? Like, that's kind of going
to
be
the vibe. Had to beat, you know, they beat France on penalties, they beat the Netherlands on penalties. Like, it wasn't an easy ride. No. I just don't see everything falling into place again for them. Yeah. But, you know, listen, they're dangerous. You got the best player of all time in your side. You know, you're always in with a sniff. But if they still got Di Maria out there and, like, I don't know if I want Lautaro up front. He just never does it in an Argentina shirt. You know what I mean? Like the Dybala, like it's the same guys. Yeah. You know what I mean?
They need that next generation to kind of come through. Because, I mean, Enzo really hasn't kicked on since his move to Chelsea. You've seen glimpses. I think, like you said, Garnacho, Alvarez, that's the makings of something. Yeah. But you kind of need maybe another combative kind of midfielder next to Enzo with a bit more legs underneath him. You know, you got McAllister there, but I tend to agree. I think the stars aligned in Qatar. I find it hard to believe, even though they sit number one in the FIFA rankings. Part of that is just due to the way the point system works. I don't think they'll go into the tournament as favorites, or at least I don't think they should. All right, moving on to our random, not so random segment of the week. We've got a fun one this week. We're going to do a ranking. We've got 10 teams to rank, and these 10 teams all have something in common. They all won the Premier League in the last 10 years. A lot of Man City, unfortunately. A couple Chelsea, a Liverpool, and obviously the big Leicester City. So we're going to get into that and rank these teams. All right, let's start. Beginning, I think we just go one by one. We go 10-1. Is that good with you?
Yeah, 10-1 is good.
Okay, I've got my list here ready to go.
Yeah.
I'll start things off.
Yeah.
It pains me to say this, because this team, who I have in 10th, so the worst out of the worst quality team to have won the Premier League in the last 10 years, is probably, not probably, is definitely by far my favorite team to have won the Premier League, just in terms of the guys they had and the way they won it. It's got to be the 2015-16 Leicester City team. I mean, just from a points total perspective, they pale in comparison to some of these Man City and Liverpool teams, even some of these Chelsea teams that won the league. That being said, this was a magnificent team. I get goosebumps still watching clips of Vardy and Mahrez and Shinji Kagawa and just Ranieri on the touchline. I mean, it sometimes still doesn't even feel real that this team won the league, but, you know, Wes Morgan, captain. You had Kasper Schmeichel, the son of a legend, in goal. You know, Danny Simpson at right back. Danny Drinkwater in midfield, who, you know, went on to Chelsea later on. It was just an unbelievable story. However, if you put all these teams in a knockout tournament or a group stage, I don't think this Leicester team beats any of the rest.
No.
So I have them in 10th.
I had the same thing. Yeah, not much more to add. They have, I think, the lowest points per game average out of these teams, 2.13. 81 points. You don't win the league with that these days, do you? So, yeah, I mean, it may be the best achievement given where they came from and the story there. I mean, you won't find a better narrative. And it's certainly something I'll never forget. And it was a fun side. You know, I mean, listen, Mahrez and Vardy and Okazaki, like, whoa, what a team. But I think definitely the worst of the bunch, unfortunately, for them.
Yeah, agree. This is where things kind of get interesting
now.
Yeah,
it's hard.
Really hard. I'm, like, struggling to differentiate which team was which. But I've kind of, like, I have a couple words just next to each team to remind me of who they are. In ninth, I've got the 2020-2021 Man City team. This was the COVID year.
I believe
86 points was, one of the COVID years. 86 points won the league. It was the year, and this is what I had to differentiate them. It was the year that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's Man United finished second.
And that's a good point.
That kind of summed it up for me. Liverpool had a down year. It was the second year in a row that Leicester had bottled top four. This was West Ham's year. We finished sixth. That should kind of give you a tale of how poor the league was a bit, although I loved that West Ham team. This was the year Man City brought in Ruben Diaz. It was kind of the end of, Kompany was gone at this point. De Bruyne was still doing his thing. It was kind of a league won by committee. They didn't have anyone in particular other than the usual names that really had an unbelievable year like a couple of these other teams did. So I had the 2020-2021 Man City team in ninth.
Yeah, this batch of three was very close to differentiate. I had Mourinho's Chelsea.
Okay.
Who, again, all from here up, like, all these teams are really good.
Yeah.
Mourinho's Chelsea was 87 points, 2.29 points per game, only three defeats. I mean, again, it's fine margins, but it is a sort of transition period for Chelsea. Terry and Cahill sort of still there. John Terry's still the captain coming to the end. Ivanovic, Azpilicueta, so a solid base, of course, but still 32 goals conceded. It wasn't Mourinho's best Chelsea team by any means. Of course, the first time around, I think was far better. The midfield, Fabregas, of course, comes in. Matic, Ramirez, Johnny Obi, Mikel. I think Chelsea have seen some better midfields than that, but still solid. And then you've got Oscar, Willian, and Hazard, who had 14 goals that season. So very strong. And, of course, Diego Costa as well,
who
hit 20 goals. And Drogba was still kicking around. So a good team. I had another Chelsea team slightly higher. But it was tough to pick from here on out. But 87 points. Mourinho's return in 2014-15 are my ninth placed team for this ranking.
Yeah, I'll just add on quickly. They were my team in eighth place.
There you go.
It was a good Chelsea team, a great Chelsea team when they won the league. But I do think the other Chelsea team in this list and the rest of these teams were just significantly better. And it's probably unfair to take into consideration, but I did kind of take into consideration how quickly the wheels fell off the very next year and how bad Chelsea were. Jose was gone. They had, Shakespeare as interim manager, and then the next guy was brought in, who we'll get to in a little bit. So they were my eighth place team. Who did you have in eighth?
So I had COVID Man City in eighth, who we already kind of spoke about. I also thought, like, if these teams matched up against each other, who would win? I just fancy the Pep teams, in most scenarios.
That's a fair point.
With Jesus and Aguero, Sterling, sort of prime Sterling, Bernardo Silva, De Bruyne, Gundogan, Rodri, Foden. Like, this was sort of the start of the, I would say, Pep's sort of second phase, with Aguero phasing out and Fernandinho phasing out, Rodri coming in, Foden coming in, sort of the new look midfield. Really solid team. Pretty close to the Chelsea teams, I think. Maybe the worst of the City teams, I guess, but it's pretty slim pickings. But they didn't hit 90 points, so I think that was sort of the decider for me. 86 points puts them eighth on my list.
All right, moving to seventh spot. This is where things get, for me, controversial, interesting. Use whatever word you want. I have last year's Man City team in seventh spot. Part of this is kind of not reverse of, maybe it's the reverse of recency bias in the team I have above them. But this Man City team, I mean, they were phenomenal. Phil Foden is the name I have written down next to this team because he was probably the best player in the league, scored that goal on the final day within, I think, 2 minutes against West Ham. That kind of just settled all the nerves because the title did go down to the final day, but, you know, they smashed us. I just think the rest of these teams were that much better. I do. I think there were times last year where I really thought Arsenal were going to win the league, that Liverpool might win the league. And with some of these teams, it was just never in doubt. And I think there really isn't much. I'll explain my sixth place team a bit more as to why I have them sixth, because it's really a toss-up. But I had the 23-24 Man City team.
Okay, yeah, I have them higher. I had Conte's Chelsea. Okay. Here, which, you know, again, a really good team. 93 points, 30 wins, 3 draws, 5 defeats, 33 goals conceded. It was the back three revolution. Yeah. It was Marcus Alonso, who scored 6 goals that season. Cahill, Aspilicueta, David Luiz, Victor Moses. Yeah. It was a new look sort of team, and Fabregas was great that season. Hazard got 16 goals. Pedro and Willian were great. Diego Costa, Batshuayi off the bench. I compare that squad to the City teams, and I can't put them ahead of them. It'd be a fascinating game, but I just think when you compare the sort of De Bruyne's and Rodri's and Fernandinho's of the world, I hand it to Pep just slightly, but tough to say because it is different eras. But 93 points is solid from that Conte team, who were, you know, a one and done, but that was a hell of a season for Chelsea. I think that was their, I mean, maybe the best team I've seen from Chelsea live. You know, in terms of, you know, I wasn't really there for the Terry Carvalho sort of years. But yeah, I had them in seventh.
I had them in sixth. I'm partially romanticizing Conte a bit. I just thought he was brilliant. I thought this team was brilliant. I thought, relatively speaking, compared to the rest of the league, they were just so dominant. I mean, they went on a stretch. There are records of, you know, they'll bring up these graphics nowadays of these Liverpool and Man City runs, of unbeaten runs. And this Chelsea team's on that list. Like, they're up there with how dominant they were. And I do think, I mean, this is me, again, it's a bit of nostalgia, a bit of romanticism of just pre-Pep times because he's ruined the game. No, but something like that. I don't disagree with you that I probably give the edge on paper to the Rodri's and the Fodens over the Victor Moses and the Fabregas. Yeah. But I just really like this team, and I loved prime Conte at Chelsea. It was just a match made in heaven.
It was.
So I had them sixth above last year's Man City team.
Okay, sixth, I have the False Nine team, as I've been calling them, for Man City. 2021-2022.
Okay.
Same points total as Conte's Chelsea. Same points per game, so very close. They conceded less goals, which is sort of the deciding factor there, and I have them lower than the other City teams because of the False Nine, to be honest. I think when Haaland comes into the picture, they are that much better, I think. It's slim pickings. De Bruyne was great that season, 15 goals, 8 assists. Bernardo Silva with 8 goals. Fernandinho in his prime. Gundogan, Rodri's first season, he wasn't quite where he is now. Sterling, 13 goals. Foden with 9. Grealish's first season. Mahrez is last season. Jesus still there. This was a really solid team. And the defense as well, with, you know, Ederson, Laporte, Walker, Cancelo was great. Diaz and Stones were great. Zinchenko there. Nathan Ake. They had everything bar the striker, and they still put up 93 points. So pretty impressive stuff. Maybe the league wasn't quite as competitive as it is right now, the last 2 years, I would say. Maybe that's why they're slightly lower for me. But still a hell of a team. So, yeah, I've got the False Nine Man City team, as I'm calling them, in sixth.
Well, that False Nine Man City team, is that I have them in fifth.
Okay.
Was that not the year Gundogan won it for them on the final day? I think it was.
2022. Yeah, because it wasn't last year.
It wasn't last year.
The year before.
Yeah. I have them there. That's the note I wrote down, Gundogan final day. And
okay,
when I'm comparing these teams, it's kind of like, well, something has to distinguish them. And I think the fact it was that close has them slightly lower than some of these other teams. But there really is not much to distinguish. I mean, you kind of touched on all the important points there on the guys they had. The false nine system, winning it with a false nine was incredibly impressive. Gundogan is the guy I kind of want to outline from this point. I think he really shined this year. Obviously went on to captain them the next year when they won the treble, which we'll get to inevitably. Mm-hmm. But he really – that I mean, it was it's an embarrassment of riches of moments if you're a Man City fan, because that Gundogan moment is brilliant. But, like, it's not even really talked about that much. Like, it should be in the same breath as that Aguero QPR moment. You know, think? Why not? I mean, just because you won.
That was the first one.
They were down.
If you isolate both moments, I see what you're saying.
Right, and they were down 2-0 against a better team. I know Villa weren't the Villa they are now, but like Coutinho scored. Liverpool thought, this is it. Like, Coutinho scoring for Villa against Man City, and they still found a way. I couldn't believe it when it happened. Then Salah scored like a minute later, and he thought he had won it. And then he was looking at the crowd, and they were like, they goes 2-1.
Remember that. That was yes.
But this is what I'm saying. There's so many moments that you get caught up.
Great final day. That's a lovely anecdote, because I remember I was in the Everton away end at Arsenal.
Right.
And the mood was awful because Liverpool were winning, and some guy was like, I can't go back. You know, it's like they didn't want to get on the train back. And then we realized City had scored and started cheering. And even the Arsenal fans were like, what is going on? They were like, wait, are Man City winning? We were like, yeah, it's 3-2. So, yeah, great moment. The only thing that puts – I'll get on to my fifth place team, I guess. The Foden season of last year, as I've sort of called it, ahead of this team is because of Haaland. The addition – I mean, it's a very similar team. You just slip Haaland's 27 goals in, and I think – and Alvarez, too. I mean, that was quite the strike force. And Foden with 19. You know, what you gain in Foden and Haaland, you lose a bit of De Bruyne. So it is sort of fine margins. But with a striker like that, I just had to give them the edge. And it was very close. 91 points versus 93. So the Foden team got less defeats, but less points. So it's like, you know, you could go either way with this argument. But yeah, I had last year's Man City team in fifth.
It's a fair pick. My fourth place team, and this is crazy that this team is in fourth.
Yeah.
I have the treble winners.
Wow.
Fourth.
Interesting.
And it's only because I just remember these top three teams, which we'll get into, having a bit more of a wow factor when I watch them. Like, the Man City team that won the treble was brilliant, obviously. I mean, Rodri scored a great goal in the Champions League final. But I almost think that the teams that didn't win the Champions League were just as good. And I know they didn't get over the hump, but I think the teams were better. We'll get on to who those teams are. There's two Man City teams in particular and a Liverpool team that I think are better than this Man City treble-winning team, which is crazy to say, but I truly think that Man City should have more Champions Leagues than they do. And it was just this team that happened to get over the hump. Because there's a randomness to knockout football. You see it with Madrid all the time, of maybe not always winning when you deserve it. And I think this Man City team deserved to win the Champions League more times than they have. And ironically, the time they did, I think the team wasn't actually as just wow. And I'll get into it when I talk about these next couple teams. But yeah, I mean, controversial, foolish, whatever you want. I have them in fourth.
I have it makes for an interesting discussion. I've got the 18-19 team, which is absurd to say because they got 98 points.
Yep.
Why did I have them there? I don't know. I mean, they're pretty damn good. Are they as good as the – I sort of tried to compare the defenses a little bit. I think the 23-24 treble winner team – I don't want to spoil the rest of my picks, but I think City have had some better defenses than Laporte was great that season. But I just look at like Delph and Danilo, I'm like, you're not getting near the team now.
Right.
So, I mean, again, it's very fine margins, but that was an argument I sort of tried to implement. Not De Bruyne's best season, but Aguero had a great season that year with 21 goals. Sterling got 17 goals. Sané with 10 goals. That was a great front three. Maybe it's the best one they've had, we'll get into the comparisons because I've got, you know, three more teams to discuss. But, yeah, I mean, listen, 2.58 points per game is no slouch. That is quite something. So 98 points. It's hard to put them this low, but I don't know. I looked at, I think when you introduce Rodri and Haaland, I think they went to a whole new level. Did they play as good football? Maybe not. Maybe that's what you're sort of remembering too. I think you're right.
Yeah.
But I think when you put these teams up against each other, I just think there's some cheat codes in these new Man City teams that I think would, I think they can beat anyone, you know, and they did beat everyone in the treble winning season. But yeah, so 18-19 Man City was quite the side. I think they dominated the league that year because it was obviously pre-Liverpool victory. Or was it, did Liverpool come close that year too? I don't remember.
That was 98-97.
That was the 98-97.
Yeah.
So yeah, to get nearly 100 points again is quite something. But top four, if that means anything.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important that I distinguish. The way I'm kind of looking at this ranking is not necessarily, I don't think it's necessarily the same way you are in like player for player.
Yeah.
As it's much, it's just team for team and the way I remember the team.
Mm.
So in third place, I have that 18-19 City team.
Okay, yeah, pretty close.
Because of the Sané. It was Sterling at his peak. Aguero was still firing. I remember that Vincent Kompany goal against Leicester. I remember that brilliant game against Liverpool with the goal line clearance that won them the league, essentially in retrospect. It was John Stones clearing it off the line. This was the team following the team I have, who we'll get to later on, continuing that blistering pace with a team behind them, with Liverpool behind them, because that year they first won it, they just blew everyone away. This year, Liverpool was with them every step of the way, and they still were magnificent. And there, I do want to touch on a point you made. I just think these teams were a bit more gung-ho.
Yeah,
and
they were.
I remember being, like I said, I remember being wowed by them. Whereas nowadays with Pep, I'm not wowed by Man City. I'm like, yeah, they're really good. And they're really kind of, their games are really boring because they just dominate you, right? So it's kind of, the rankings are perspective based, I think. So I had that 18-19 City team in third.
Yeah, I had Klopp's Liverpool in third, just ahead of this team. Why? Well, they got one more point, maybe, you know. But again, it's, I think that Liverpool team, you talk about dominating.
Yeah.
They won the league in January. I mean, they were invincible until Watford beat them.
Yep, I remember that.
Whatever, the latter half of that season. I mean, that team was absurd. Trent got 13 assists from right back. I mean, it was nuts. Salah got 19 goals. Mane got 18 goals. Firmino got 9. That front three, that was the best sort of season of them, obviously. And they deserved to get over the line. They finally did. And the manner in which they did was quite something, the way they dominated the league that season. Again, 99 points is pretty insane, 2.61 points per game. That's just a monstrous total. Why are they not higher? 33 goals conceded, really, is the only sort of argument. Again, I sort of did it slightly different to you. I'm sort of comparing squad for squad. Are Van Dijk and Joe Gomez the best partnership on the list? Maybe not.
Mm.
But the way they dominated the Premier League that season is quite something. That was a special team.
Yeah, I have them in second. They're my second place team. I think it's unfortunate for Liverpool fans that after coming so close so multiple times, the one they won it was the COVID one where they had to celebrate in an empty stadium. And you know, I'm sure Liverpool fans will still appreciate the memories they had up until, you know, March time. It's also, I think, important to note that this team won the league immediately after they won the Champions League. They won the Champions League in the spring of that 2019. I think they won the club world, the Super Cup, I remember, against Chelsea. You know, that was when Lampard was the coach there. And like you said, they were just magnificent. And you know, this is a key thing. So we're going through all these teams, and we have different ways to like kind of demark them. This team was so, I just remember their kit. I remember the lines going down their kit. I remember when it was their last year with New Balance. I could just envision Trent. I remember the beautiful goal he scored at Leicester. He kind of let it come to him and struck it with the outside of his foot. And they deserved the league. This team, I mean, deserves a lot more than they got. I mean, multiple times missing out by a point. But this was, I think, the best version of, like you said, Mane, Salah, Firmino, Van Dijk at his best. Henderson was still really good. It was Robertson and Trent at their best. And Klopp in full force. And like you said, I mean, they won it at a canter. I think the history books won't really, look at it the same way, because, or maybe the history books will be kind because they'll just look at the points total, whereas our memories are like, they got so far ahead and then the league stopped. And then they kind of finished it off. It was untraditional in that sense, but they were magnificent. They're only behind the one team I have in first.
Yeah,
who did you
which
have second?
Must be the Centurions, because that's who
correct.
I have in second. What a team. 100 points. I think this is the team I enjoy watching the most on this list. And listen, they weren't leaking goals either. 27 goals conceded is not many. I don't think it's the best defense. That's probably what differentiated them from who I have top. With, you know, Otamendi, Fabian Delph, Walker, Danilo, Stones and company still there, obviously. But, you know, Yaya Toure was still around. It was De Bruyne. It was Bernardo Silva. It was Fernandinho in his prime. It was David Silva. Mm. And it was Jesus and Aguero, who got 13 goals and 21 goals, respectively. But the Sané Sterling, this is like the Sané Sterling season for me. Like, they were electric to watch, especially Leroy Sané, man, on the wing. He was just a cheat code. I like those sort of traditional pacey wingers. So that was just so fun to watch. And, you know, the Aguero swan song, of course, he's a player that I just love. And, you know, they have the highest points total of any Premier League team in history. So that has to count for something.
Yeah, that's my number one team, the Centurions. And I think after going through this list, and you said it just then, this was maybe your favorite team to watch. That's kind of how I've ranked this and how, like I said, how this team's made me feel watching them. And I'm not a fan of any of these teams, but it's just from a neutral perspective. Leroy Sané was one of my favorite players to watch pre-ACL injury.
Yeah.
I don't think he's ever been the same. I don't think Raheem Sterling has really reached the levels that he reached at this season. I think it was the best Raheem Sterling you got. It was Aguero still in his pomp. You still had Fernandinho and company, like you said, but there was still David Silva popping up. I mean, they were just relentless, and it was... It was great to see Pep conquer the Premier League at a time where it wasn't boring for him to do so. Because now it's a bit boring. It's a bit like we know how good he is. Whereas at the time, if you remember, in 2016-17, they struggled a bit. They got
his
top
first
four.
Season.
His first season was a struggle. And so it was like, okay, here's Pep. Here's this greatest manager ever. But can he do it in the Premier League? And he shut everybody up. And they were brilliant to watch. They were a magnificent team. And they did it in an entertaining way. I think even now, looking back, there's less disdain I have for those Man City teams compared to these newer ones because of the way they went about their business and the way they just scored so many goals, and they were fun with Jesus and all these guys in attack. So they're my number one. So I think that leaves
the treble winners for
me.
And listen, not the best Man City team to watch, but for me, maybe the most well-rounded City team. Haaland is really the difference here with 36 goals he got that season. I mean, are you kidding me? Alvarez was there with 9. Gundogan was still there before he left. Rodri, of course. De Bruyne, even though he was injured, was still fantastic. He got 16 assists. He missed like two-thirds of the season. It was unreal. It was just a cheat code. And again, it's not my favorite City team. But I sort of, my take on this was, you know, who would win if the two faced off? And this team, you know, they couldn't lose a game. They were on a mission that season, and they just could not be stopped. They were an absolute machine. Defensively, they were, I think, probably the best they've been with that sort of the way Pep tweaked it to have just out-and-out center backs, Stones stepping into midfield, Ake, Diaz, Walker, Akanji behind him. So solid. So hard to beat they were that season. I think they were harder to beat than maybe the teams that are a bit more free-flowing, a bit more early Pep, a bit more fun to watch. So, and of course, you've got, you know, Foden, Grealish, Mahrez in attack. Just brilliant. They had the quality, but they had the robustness. They had the physicality that they maybe hadn't had. And that got them over the line in the Champions League. It only got them 89 points in the Premier League, but still, I think to win on three fronts is quite an achievement, and the way they did it, like I said, not the sexiest team of all time in the Premier League, but boy, what a team that was. And Erling Haaland, man, I think he's gonna go down as with Henry, I think, is the best Premier League striker forward we will have ever seen. He's that clinical in front of goal.
Yeah, I know I had this team a bit lower, but you can't really argue with any of that. And I think the way you kind of constructed your list makes sense that this team is at the forefront.
Yeah.
All right, that will do it for our rankings. I mean, a lot of Man City. We're hoping the next 10 years, a bit more parity, hopefully, a bit more split. But that will do it. And until next time, thank you for listening.